quick, because we spent a lot of time last week just talking about viruses. And incidentally, I really want to encourage you, when people are worried about this coronavirus and ask you the question, why would a good God create viruses? Remember what I shared with you last week. We wouldn't be here without viruses. Viruses are good, but it's human abuse that causes viruses to get out of control and become as deadly as this new coronavirus is. So don't put the blame on God. It was a human abuse that caused viruses of this nature to mutate and be the problem. But just to quickly review, yes. How many types of viruses are there? Well, okay, that's a difficult question because it's not like what we have with birds and mammals and reptiles and amphibians, where you can kind of see distinct species. Basically, with viruses, you're getting different strains or breeds. So there is no definition of a virus species. Moreover, there's a big debate within science whether or not viruses are really alive. They simply are little, like little protein parts, or little DNA parts. And there's one theory that viruses are basically what happened to the, God created the bacteria, and then some of them decayed and little bits and pieces basically evolved and became viruses. That's one idea. Others people think that viruses were created. But technically, they're not alive. They cannot survive without a host. So they're a parasite. And what you're getting is just one little piece of what a true life form would be. So think of it as a bacterium, where you take just one little piece out of the bacterium. And what the virus has to do, it has to invade a cell in order to be able to reproduce. But what it does, it invades a cell and reproduces that little piece, and it goes and invades another cell. And the successful viruses are the ones that don't kill all the cells, they simply reproduce. But ones of this nature actually start killing cells, and this is where you get the deadly material. But as I mentioned last week, viruses have significant benefits for life. If it wasn't for the fact that viruses were here right from the very first life form, I mean, the first bacteria we know date back to 3.825 billion years ago. We now have an accurate date for that. Viruses must have been here at the same time. If they weren't here at the same time, bacteria would have multiplied and filled the whole planet. As I mentioned last week, without viruses, our planet Earth would be a gigantic bacterial slime ball, and there'd be no room for any other life. Planet would only have bacteria, and eventually the bacteria would multiply to such a degree that they would all go dead, and the planet would become sterile. And so without viruses, planet Earth would have quickly become sterile of all life. The bacteria have multiplied to such a point that they would have wiped themselves all out. But thanks to viruses, the viruses attack the bacteria and keep the bacteria at a low enough population level that the bacteria actually survive and actually create room for other life forms. So that's the fundamental benefit of bacteria, but they form another huge benefit, as what you see in Creation Day 2, where the Genesis 1 talks about how there's water above and water below. If you go to Job 37 and 38, it talks about how God set up this amazingly crafted water cycle, where you got water being evaporated from the oceans and lakes, and it forms rain and snow, and that rain and snow falls upon the earth, and you get this water cycle. And if you read Job 37 and 38 in some depth, I think it was about a year ago we went through those texts, and we actually identified 16 different kinds of precipitation that are mentioned in Job 37 and 38. And how each of those forms of precipitation is crucial for advanced life to exist in all the continental land masses. So for example, we would not be able to grow the crops that we grow here in California if most of our precipitation didn't fall as snow on our high mountains. The advantage of the frozen precipitation, it melts very slowly. So it provides a steady stream of water to irrigate the agricultural valleys here in California. And to this day, more than half the fruits and vegetables of the US of A comes from the valleys here in California. But those valleys are basically watered by frozen precipitation that accumulates on the high mountains. Now, viruses contribute at least half, if not two-thirds, of all the seeds that are necessary to make hail, snow, rain, mist, dew, etc. The water cycle will not operate unless you've got these little seeds in the atmosphere that form a point where water molecules can collect. So the water vapor by itself will not form precipitates. It needs material in the atmosphere, little tiny microscopic seeds. And the viruses float up into the atmosphere and they form these seeds. But they also contribute by going after the bacteria, killing the bacteria, and then little pieces of the bacteria float up in the atmosphere, and they too form seeds for the rain and the snow and the other forms of precipitation. So yeah, we would not have the water cycle that we have if it wasn't for the bacteria or the viruses. And the viruses, because they're carbonaceous in their constituents, they form a critical component of the carbon cycle. So the capacity of our planet to recycle carbon throughout the environment critically depends upon the viruses. So don't badmouth viruses. They're a good force for life here on planet Earth. And where they become bad is when we humans violate the commands you see in the Torah, particularly in the Book of Leviticus. The Book of Leviticus is filled with statements about how we should live and manage our civilization, how we should be caring for our animals, how we should be caring for one another, and preventing the spread of diseases. As Moses said in the introduction, there is that we will not have the diseases of the Egyptians. We will not have the diseases of the Egyptians because we're going to live a different way. We're not going to jam all of our animals so tightly together that it creates a breeding environment for these dangerous viral species to take place. And this is, you know, the really dangerous viruses have come out of these big markets in China where you walk down the main street. I was going to bring a photo for you because I found it on the internet. It shows this photo, and it's basically about a half mile long of chickens, live chickens. But the chickens are jammed so tightly together that they're super stressed. And it's not like here, where you kind of buy your chicken in these little plastic wrap packages. What you have are people saying, no, I want to actually see the live chickens. And I get to pick the chicken I want, and that's dinner for tonight. But the problem is you've got all these birds jammed very tightly together in a highly stressed environment, and you've got millions of people in close contact with them. That's a perfect environment for a virus to mutate and for that mutated virus to hop from a host, a different animal host, to a human being. And that's literally where most of the dangerous viruses have come from. And as I mentioned last week, bestiality is another way. They think HIV was propagated through bestiality. So. And this, I mean, I think one thing that might come out of this is that we now see, and by the way, I'm not saying it was chickens in Wuhan that gave forth a virus. They're actually thinking it might have been live fish or live octopi, but that's something you see in that part of the world is where they actually have all kinds of live animals in these dense cities where the animals are densely packed together and in close contact with people. And so they still don't know exactly which one of these animals was the source for this coronavirus. But in Wuhan, they had all kinds of animals across the whole spectrum. And again, that's a dangerous place for mutating these viruses because you've got different kinds of animals that can hop from one animal to another animal to another animal and eventually to a human being. It's still a mystery exactly what was the cause of this virus. But the whole point is, if we violate what the Bible says about how we should live, how we should manage our animals, don't be surprised if things like this happen. Yes?
I just wanted to mention, when we went to see the orthopedic surgeon this week, I said, let's have the surgery right away before the coronavirus hits, you know? And he said, You have to understand that the doctors are all laughing about this because 10,000 people die of flu every year, and we have 11 deaths so far. It's probably up by now. He said, CNN just needs something to report. I thought that was interesting.
Well, it is, and yeah, it won't, I mean, you can, as I mentioned last week, the best website to go to get the information is the one maintained by Johns Hopkins. They pull in data from WHO, from CDC, everywhere. And yeah, there are people saying this is going to blow over and not be a big deal. Others are saying it could be something that we look back upon and say, wow, that was really, really bad. And so it's going to be somewhere in between. And for those of you who are wondering kind of what my prognosis on this is, I would say this. Watch what's happening in the area of Seattle. Right now, they got over 100 cases of coronavirus, and there are people saying that could be where it goes up to 10,000. If that happens, you know it's going to be bad. If it doesn't happen, then things aren't going to be so bad. And yeah, don't be surprised that the death rate right now is high, because typically the people most at risk, they get sick faster than healthier people, because the incubation period can be anywhere from 2 days to 2 weeks. But someone who's more likely to die from it likely is going to be getting symptoms within 2 or 3 days. And so the data will be a bit skewed, and people are expecting that the death rate will drop. And by the way, we don't even know. I mean, people in South Korea are kind of laughing at us here in America because we're just not testing to the degree they are. I think they're testing 100,000 people a day. We're testing, what, maybe a couple hundred a day. So there could be a lot of cases here in America we don't know about. I think one reason for some concern is when you look at what's happening in Western Europe, where you got Germany, France, and Italy, and now England seeing a lot of cases. And in particular, Italy saw more than 2,000 cases in a single day. And so, but they've actually shut down all movie theaters, all gyms, schools, and also churches. And they are leaving restaurants open, but the rule of the restaurant is nobody can sit next to anyone else that's not at least a meter away. So the restaurants no longer have people jammed tightly, they're all spread out. If they're not, they close the restaurant down. Yeah, Milan and Venison are, in fact, 16 million people in Italy now cannot leave their city. So yeah, there are cities that have actually been quarantined. However, I looked at the figures today, and instead of 2,300 new cases, they only had 900 new cases. So we'll see. What I would tell you is this. I think within the next week or two, we're going to know what we can expect here. So. And I'm actually scheduled to be in Virginia next week, so I'm not going to be here. But I can tell you this, if things get to a point where it's unsafe to be in airports, I'm going to be here next Sunday. So if you see me here next Sunday, maybe you need to worry. On the other hand, I can tell you this, worst case scenario, it might get to be like Italy, where we're not going to have movie theaters or gymnasiums or stadiums or entertainment places open, or even churches. On the other hand, that doesn't mean church will stop. It doesn't mean this class will stop. In fact, I had a meeting with Josh Swanson, the senior pastor here last week, saying, if things really get bad, we don't shut the church down. We don't shut Paradoxes down. We make it virtual. So I will come. The media people will come. We'll get everything going live stream. You can stay at home. In the protection of your home, and you can participate in the class. We'll still take questions from you through the computer. That's the worst case scenario. Will the doors be locked? Well, I've heard if people sit 6 feet away from one another, the risk is really low, as long as you're not showing symptoms. If you're showing symptoms, obviously stay home. So we could have a few of you here, but I would say that's the worst case thing, is that you're still part of the class, but you might not be here in person. And that's the amazing thing about having this happen in the 21st century. We got the technology where we can still congregate together without being in close contact with one another. Amen. And so, yeah, they're making preparations to actually do services in the church here, where maybe there's only 10 people in the sanctuary, and everybody else is at home participating through their smartphones, their iPads, and other devices. However, it may not come to that. And so if I'm not here next week, that means you can be more optimistic. Basically, although I did tell people, don't fly me through LAX. So I'm flying out of Ontario. And I also said, well, we don't think you should go through Chicago. Denver doesn't have any cases. We'll fly you through Denver. Guess what? Denver's got a bunch of cases now. So yeah, and our virologist, she basically said, I'm not going into any airport. She said, that's kind of the highest risk place to be. But hey, her comment too was, if this is really bad, it's going to peak in August. And so we're quite a ways off from the peak. Frankly, I think I'm going to be in Virginia next week because I don't see it being that bad. But again, go to that website. It'll give you a good idea. Watch what happens in Seattle. Watch what happens at LAX. Those will be good bellwethers as to whether or not things are getting bad enough that you need to take action. And you know, what bothers me is I go into these supermarkets and places like Walmart, and all kinds of stuff is missing. People are going crazy. You can't even buy toilet paper in these places anymore. So, I mean, you can survive in your home and still go to and get some shopping done. So, but and by the way, the stock market has gone down except for Clorox. They're skyrocketing. So, you? One more question? Yes.
And also, the stock went up for the company that's developing the vaccine and all that. But I'm just thinking, this could be like something, not to instill panic on anyone, but this could start famines in third world countries and stuff if it gets into the populations of poor nations, you know? And what do you think of that?
Well, that people have been commenting on it, I don't think it's a big risk. Again, worst case scenario, the trade still happens. But what happens is that these people on these big ships, they stay on the ship. And so your goods will still travel. I don't think that's going to be an issue.
Quick comment. The surgeon said masks do not help.
Yeah, masks do not help. Where the masks do help, if you've got the coronavirus, it'll give you some protection about giving it to somebody else. So it basically stops the person who's already diseased from spreading it to some degree. But if you don't have the disease, yeah, it's not going to do anything. I've not bought a mask. And by the way, the companies are selling masks. Their stocks are going up, too. People are panicking. So,
The thing about masks is they kind of, if that's the case, you know, and if you're wearing a mask, people will get away from you because they think you have it. You know, so it's kind of a catch-22.
Well, one doctor I said the biggest benefit of wearing a mask is that you're less likely to be touching your face in such a way that you infect yourself. So, and what's interesting, they did a study on graduate students because they said, you know, the thing is, well, you know, when this virus goes, don't touch your face. Do you know how hard it is not to touch your face? Okay, especially those of us who are older. What I didn't realize, the older you get, the itchier your face becomes. And so, like, I'm scratching my face all the time, but they did this study on young graduate students, even those that are in their 20s, they're touching their face an average of 30 times an hour. So the idea of wearing a mask is, okay, you'll be touching the mask and not your face. So it might be good to wear a mask just for that reason alone. But just try this as an exercise this afternoon. See if you can go a whole hour without touching your face. Well, that's it. That's I kind of did that on myself. So you know what? When I try not to touch my face feels even itchier than it does. I'm not thinking about it. So
hey, Hugh,
yeah.
The woman who said that when she was reading the report, then changed the page by licking her finger to change the page.
Pardon me?
The woman who said that on television, after she read that, she went and changed the page.
Oh yeah. Yeah, it's just really hard. But again, it just shows you how easy it is for these viruses to be propagated. Pardon me? Well, I've talked to astronauts, and the question was, I know you heard it, what about astronauts? And how do they get, because I mean, they can't touch their face, they've got this thing around them, and they can't wait to get it off. And so that was what they told the Apollo astronauts, you only have to wear it for, you know, like an hour, and then you can take it off. But yeah, I've talked to astronauts, and they say, it says when you got that thing on your head, you just really want to scratch your head, and you just can't get to it. So, but I mean, what can you do? There's no way, so you just tolerate it. So, okay, over here again.
I wonder about people who might be older in their 80s or whatever, but are robust and are exercising and whatnot, and wonder what their risk factor is.
Well, I mean, our virologist said, Hugh, maybe you need to be more cautious because you're in your 70s and you've got asthma. And she says the stats right now say 50% death rate if you're a man over the age of 70 with asthma. But it doesn't take into account that if you're in a healthy man, I run 3 miles a day. So I'm a little more robust. I don't think my odds are that bad. But that's what and keep in mind the statistics we have now are going to skew towards those that are most vulnerable. So you see kind of the death rate, and that's what everybody is saying. You have to wait till this thing is well into its peak before you really know what the true death rate is. And the comment about the fact that men are dying at a much faster rate than women, it's based predominantly on Chinese data. And the problem in China is only 2% of women over the age of 50 smoke, 50% of men over the age of 50 smoke. So it could be the fact that they're smokers that causes them to be more susceptible than the, so maybe the death rate for men and women is the same. We just don't know. There's a lot we don't know because we're too early into the infection. A typical virus, a coronavirus like this, it takes about 9 months or a year to run its course. And here in America, we're only in it for 2 months. So we're just, it's way too early to tell what's going to happen. In the back.
Yeah, I was looking up some information about the cloud nucleation with the viruses. And I came upon this little tidbit of information. It says that in one study, they found that over 800 million viruses and tens of millions of bacteria are deposited per square meter per day from the atmosphere as a result of rain.
Yeah.
Yeah. So. Don't worry about your masks, just stay out of the rain.
Just stay out of the rain, there you go, or mist or dew, so. Okay. But that's another piece of information that tells us, hey, these viruses really do serve multiple very good, not just very good, but essential purposes.
So this study was saying that one of the reasons that viruses can get into places where the people, you can't connect them with people, is that the rain doesn't discriminate by geography.
Right.
So it doesn't care what people there are, it's going to travel from China to the United States to Peru to whatever in the wind vectors.
Well, the only continent on Earth that doesn't have a coronavirus infected people is Antarctica. South America and Africa were the last ones to be hit, but they now have cases. So it just makes the point, hey, with viruses, they float in the atmosphere, they move with winds, the precipitation brings them down, because after all, rain is typically a viral particle at the center that rain is collected around, or a bacterial phage. So anyway, I wanted to be quick on this because I really wanted to talk about what we were just getting into a couple of weeks ago. And this is based on several debates I've had with atheist scientists, where I've been put on the spot where they say, Hugh, can you name scientific discoveries or historical discoveries or whatever that would cause you to abandon your Christian faith? And I said, well, these are three I can name. There's more than these three. And incidentally, there's some things that could be discovered within nature that would be catastrophic to our Christian faith. There are other things that would be discovered that I say wouldn't be catastrophic, but would be corrosive. And then there are things that really are simply adjustments. And I mention all this in my book, More Than a Theory, but these are three that I think would be catastrophic to the Christian faith if they were proven not to be the case. In other words, if we were to prove that the universe did not have a beginning, then that's catastrophic in the sense that it means there really is no cosmic creator. And if there's no creator, then maybe I'm not created, and maybe the fundamentals of the Christian faith that talks, I mean, we've been going into the book of Isaiah. Do you remember how much the book of Isaiah talked about there's a one creator and only one creator, and that creator is responsible for everything that exists? Well, if we were to establish that the universe didn't have a beginning and there was no creator behind the universe was eternal, that would be catastrophic to the Christian faith. And likewise, the Bible is filled literally from chapter 2 of Genesis onwards with how we humans are different from all their life on the face of the earth. We alone have the image of God. We alone are stewards to manage the planet for our benefit and the benefit of all of their life. And if we were to show that we human beings are not spiritual, we're simply physical, we're just physical beings like the rest of all life here on earth, I would argue that would be catastrophic to the Christian faith, because it basically makes the point we're going to have the same fate as all other life on planet earth. We die and that's it. There is no life beyond the grave. And then the one that's mentioned by the Apostle Paul in Corinthians, if we were to prove that Jesus did not rise bodily from the dead, that would be catastrophic to our Christian faith. Because if Jesus didn't rise bodily from the dead, what evidence do we have that we're going to be raised bodily from the dead? So, and as I mentioned when we talked about this 2 weeks ago, you see this most dramatically laid out in the debate I had with the British chemist, Peter Atkins. And all you got to do is put Atkins Ross and it'll pop right up and you can watch the debate for yourself. But I think what was dramatic about that debate is the moderator, Justin Brierley, asked me if I could name some scientific discoveries that would cause me to abandon my Christian faith and become a non-theist. Then he turned to Peter Atkins, the atheist, and said, can you name some scientific discoveries that were proven beyond any shadow of doubt would cause you to abandon your atheism and become a theist? And he began by saying, well, I really can't think of any. And then the moderator said, well, what if Jesus were to show up right in front of you right now? And he says, well, that would be impressive if I actually saw Jesus of Nazareth pop up right in this room. But I think if that really happened, I would simply conclude that I was deluded, that I was having some kind of vision. And he says, yeah, that wouldn't convince me either. So basically he came and said, Rudy, there's nothing that would ever persuade me because I'm so confident that there is no God. And the whole point is that means he has a faith that's not falsifiable, that's not testable. And the drama that is for the entire hour previously, Peter was arguing and saying, if you're a Christian, you're stupid and you're lazy. You're ignorant, you're stupid, and you're lazy because you haven't done your homework. If you did, you know that there was no God, and you've got to base your beliefs on real scientific evidence. But when push comes to shove, real scientific evidence did not count. He was so committed to his... And incidentally, if you ever see that in an individual, doesn't have to be a chemist, doesn't have to be an astrophysicist, it could be anybody. When you see that, that kind of tells you that there's another reason for why they've rejected belief in God. Because when they say scientific evidence doesn't mean, isn't going to persuade me, it means there's something else in their life that caused them to take that position. And I had a chance to talk to Peter privately, and he had some pretty bitter experiences with the Anglican Church during his growing up years. And so that's often an opportunity, rather than to say, I got you, to come back and say, I think you've got a story to tell. Please tell me your story. And often when they tell their story and you listen to the story with compassion and empathy, that can be an open door. Because as it says in Matthew chapter 7, if you will not forgive others of the way they've offended you, then my Father will not forgive you for the way you've offended me. And so bitterness can be a barrier to people coming to faith in Christ. And so when you recognize that evidence is not the issue, that's basically where we need to go next. And how you get that out, hey, just say, hey, I'd like to hear your story. And, you know, whether it's being, having some bad experience in the church, or being abused by another Christian, or someone who says they're a Christian, or having a father issue or a mother issue, there's usually something like that. Got a comment here.
Dr. Ross, on YouTube, I saw a debate between William Lake Craig and Alex Rosenberg. I think he's a physicist. And he said that the reason that he can't accept Christianity is a Holocaust. So it really had nothing to do with science at all, you know, apparently. Well, not so much, anyway.
Let me get this back on. Here we go. Yeah. I interviewed David Berlinski on our TV show some 20 years ago. And, you know, he was quite clear that there is a God. And we even talked about the Trinity, and he said that really made rational sense. And he said, everything you're telling me about the Christian faith is rational. I want to believe it, but I can't. He says, I'm a Jew. I've lost relatives in the Holocaust. He says, look, I'm not trying to claim I'm being rational about this. It's an emotional issue. I can't become a Christian because of the Holocaust. And he says, I know what you're going to say. You're going to tell me that it wasn't Christians that are responsible for the Holocaust. He says, I even accept that. He says, I'm just telling you, Hugh, I'm being completely irrational in rejecting the Christian faith. But I said, no, these relatives I've lost, I mean, it's just a deep pain and a wound I have, and I can't get past it. So that's often happens with Jews. Well, I said, you know, I appreciate the fact that you're willing to admit that this is an irrational reason for rejecting the Christian faith. But I told him the story of what happened to my friend David Block. In fact, David may wind up in the class here. We're wanting to bring him. He's the chairman of the mathematics and astronomy department at Witwatersrand University. And he is a Jew that became a Christian. And yeah, we're actually trying to bring him over here as a visiting scholar. And so it'd be great to have him. In fact, if we launch this change in the class, we'll actually record what he has to say. An amazing guy. And he speaks often in audiences of 5,000 to 10,000 people. Well known there in Africa. Incidentally, he's got a very different personality than I have. If he comes here, don't be surprised if he jumps and dances around a lot. In fact, when I was speaking in South Africa, he says, Hugh, you're way too calm. This is South Africa. You got to be more flamboyant, otherwise people won't believe anything you're saying. But when we had him over here, we said, David, you need to be a little more subdued, because if you're too flamboyant here in America, people won't believe what you're saying. It really is a completely different culture. But we're both learning how to adapt. So I think he'll be more subdued when he comes here. But he was the first one in his family to become a Christian. And he told me he became a Christian through wanting to study the Old Testament and being told by rabbis, look, there are parts of the Old Testament that are too difficult to understand. And you know, the only way you're going to get to these texts is to go to rabbinical school. And so he actually talked to some of his rabbi friends and discovered, well, they don't really get into these texts either. And so he says, well, if I'm not allowed to look at this stuff in synagogue, and if I go to a rabbinical school and I don't get it there either, I'm just going to go read it for myself. So he basically says, I became a Christian through reading all the Old Testament texts my rabbis told me not to read. And that's where he discovered what the book of Isaiah said about the Trinity, what it said about the suffering servant, the fact that the Messiah comes twice, not just once. And so suddenly everything began to click, and he became a believer. But he too is in a family where he has lost a lot of relatives in the Holocaust. Same situation as with David Berlinski. And he said what happened was, when he became a Christian, his extended family held a public funeral for him. And this is typical within people who are serious, you know, Tanakh-believing Jews. If one of theirs becomes a Christian, they basically treat them as being dead. And so they held this funeral for him, and they had no contact with him. wouldn't respond to any letters or Christmas cards he sent, or, you know, but he said, all that changed when my wife and I, and by the way, his wife also was raised as a Jew and became a Christian. But he said, when we had children, the uncles and aunts and the grandparents, they had to see these new children. And so they relented. Literally for years, they pretended that David was dead and that his wife was dead, but they had to see the grandkids. And so David said, okay, you can all come over, but let's not talk about these things. And so he said there was an evening when there were over 60 of his relatives in his home getting to see the new grandkids. And he said, for some reason, my uncle picked a fight with me. And I said, uncle, I just wanted you to see the grandkids. We agreed ahead of time we weren't going to talk about our theological differences. But his uncle persisted, and David just put a stop to it and said, look, how about if we just do an experiment? He says, you all know that as Jews, we're able to emigrate to Israel. Let's all apply to emigrate to Israel. I'm not saying any of us are going to go to Israel. Let's just apply and see what happens. Now, on the application, you have to put down your religious perspective. And he says, I got cards here. He came up with, I think there were 65 of his relatives there. He came up with 65 different religious things that you could put down, from atheist to deist to Muslim and various kinds of Muslims. So they had all these detailed things. He says, I'm going to put down evangelical Christian. The rest of you pick something else. So nominal Christian was one of them. And so what happened was they got together again 3 months later, and they said, well, how many of you got accepted for immigration? Everybody did except David. He was the only one that was rejected. And so David went to his uncle and said, why was I rejected and all the rest of you were accepted? And his uncle said, we Jews only fear the truth. And he says, that night, a third of his relatives came to Christ. So I shared that with David Berlinski. He said, very interesting story, but he says, I'm still a prisoner of the Holocaust. And when he described it, he says, look, I'm an older Jew. I actually know people who died in the Holocaust. And he says, like them, I'm in the same kind of prison. I'm not in Auschwitz, but I have these walls around me that really prevent me from thinking logically and rationally through this. And that's how we left it. But as I understand it, David Berlinski is still within that little prison.
I noticed that David Berlinski gives atheists a really hard time, too.
Oh, yeah. No, he's definitely not an atheist. He describes himself as a theist. And I said to David, well, you know, are you an Orthodox Jew? He says, I do believe in the God of Judaism. But he said, I'm not really an Orthodox Jew, he says. He didn't really tell me to what degree he practices his Judaism, but he said, I like all of you Christians. I like what you say. I like what you believe in. I think your doctrines are amazing. And, you know, he didn't push back on any of the evidences I was giving him, but he just says, Hugh, you're trying to talk to me as if I'm able to think rationally and logically through these issues. I'm not. I'm a prisoner of the Holocaust. And by the way, I've heard many Jews say that to me. But it's typically those who actually know people that are their relatives that died in the Holocaust. It's different if they're a Jew and they're somewhat geographically and temporarily separated from the Holocaust. It's different for them. But for those that are older that actually know relatives that died in the Holocaust, just like David, they can be a prison. Now, do they ever get out of the prison? I know some. David himself, David Block, told me, I was able to get out of the prison because I realized, look, this is something. It was basically reading the Bible and recognizing, in fact, he told me, he says, you know, Hugh, I agree with you that Ezekiel actually predicted the Holocaust, and just seeing that in the Bible said, there's some reason why God allowed this to happen. And so that kind of helped him. But again, he said that was in a passage I was forbidden not to read. So just reading those forbidden texts really helped him to understand things. Otherwise, he wouldn't understand. Okay. I told you a couple of weeks ago I was going to focus today on human beings being exceptional. And what's really interesting is what you're seeing amongst atheist scholars is you would think all the focus would be on number three. It's not. The focus is on one and two. This is where the attacks are coming. So what I'm really realizing is a lot of scholar atheists realize that they're not going to do very well if they try to debate the resurrection. And incidentally, you can watch all kinds of debates on the resurrection on YouTube. And I'll talk a little bit about that. But what I wanted to share with you, that in terms of scholars trying to justify an atheistic worldview, they're really kind of hoping you don't bring up three. They don't want to go to three. They really want to go to one and two. And they really think they got the scientific goods on one and two. And this explains a lot of the writing we've been doing and speaking we've been doing at Reasons to Believe. Just realizing this is where the atheistic push is coming from. It's on the cosmic beginning and the exceptionalism of human beings. And with the exceptionalism of human beings, it goes all the way back to Charles Darwin, who basically made the point, look, there's a bigger distance between a fish and an ape than there is between an ape and a human. And he was the first serious scientist, biologist, to argue that we human beings are not exceptional. We're simply an extension. Yeah, we're smarter than the other animals. We have greater hand dexterity than the other animals, but we differ only by degree. We don't differ fundamentally in kind. And what's happening with number one, you've got people saying, well, yes, all the physical evidence tells us there might be a beginning, but we have theoretical models that tell us there is no beginning. But I've written about this in The Creator and the Cosmos, the fourth edition. What has happened in the 21st century that's different from the 20th century, the atheist physicists and astronomers are now appealing to what I call non-empirical arguments to avoid the conclusion that the universe has a beginning. They're basically saying, well, we don't know what's going on in the quantum gravity era, and maybe things are so exotic during that era that we can find an escape in the beginning. It says, yes, you have all these space-time theorems that prove that space and time have a beginning, that they're created. However, they're assuming that the laws of physics are the same in the quantum gravity era as they are beyond the quantum gravity era. And by the way, they keep referring to it as a quantum gravity era, and for lay people, we think of an era as a long period of time. You know how long the quantum gravity era is? It's 1/10 billionth of a trillionth of a trillionth of a trillionth of a second. 10^-43 seconds. That's how long. So they're actually calling that an era. Most lay people don't refer to a split second as an era of time. But in physics, they do. And it's basically referring to that brief moment in the early history of the universe when you have all four forces of physics unified. You've probably heard of the unified field theory, and this is the idea that when you go from the beginning of the universe to now, the universe evolves from having one force of physics to two forces of physics to three forces of physics to four forces of physics. But as the temperature goes up, those forces of physics begin to unify. The four forces of physics, you got gravity and electromagnetism, which most lay people are aware of, and then you got the strong nuclear force and the weak nuclear force. And so from the Big Bang creation event, the universe initially is so hot that all four forces of physics are blended together into a single force. And to give you an analogy that I think you're all familiar with, you take a bar magnet, and if you heat the bar magnet up, the magnetism disappears. It doesn't really disappear. What happens is the magnetic energy and the heat energy blend together so that you can't distinguish the two. But you can cool a magnet, and if you do it the right way, the magnetism returns. So that's an example where one form of energy can split and become two forms of energy if the magnet becomes cool enough that that now becomes possible. So similar analogy. And the first force to separate out would be gravity. And so you have the four forces of physics. As the universe expands, and any system that expands will get cooler, And so as universe cools, gravity separates, and so you've got the gravitational force and what you call the strong electro-weak force, where you've got the strong nuclear force, the weak nuclear force, and electromagnetism still uniting. Where that separation happens is at 10 to the minus 43 seconds after the cosmic creation event. However, where atheists are going, they're saying, we have no way to create the energy density that exists in the quantum gravity era. And so we're assuming that the physics operates similar to what we see now, but maybe it could be different. And what they're basically saying is, it's during the quantum gravity era that we got the possibility that quantum mechanical forces will be stronger than the gravitational forces. I mean, so they're basically saying, and so these space-time theorems basically assume that general relativity applies in the quantum gravity era in a similar way that it does beyond the quantum gravity era, and basically saying there's no way to test that. Since there's no way to test that, we're free to speculate that things could be radically different than what we would presume they would be, and therefore it's those speculations where they say we can actually come up what they call quantum eternity theorems, where they basically speculate that the quantum mechanical space-time fluctuations are so extremely large that it opens up a possibility that the space-time theorems don't hold all the way back to the beginning, and therefore the universe may not have a finite time. It may be eternal. And most of these models imply that you've got a previous universe where the universe, instead of expanding, is contracting. And then it contracts all the way down where it's smaller than what you'd expect in the beyond the quantum gravity era, and then it evolves and becomes an expanding universe. And the more sophisticated models are saying maybe this goes on ad infinitum. But it's all based on the fact that we don't have the measurements to prove whether or not these speculations really work. Now, as I mentioned, The Creator and the Cosmos, fourth edition, we do have space-time theorems that tell us if these quantum space-time fluctuations, rather than being really large, are actually more moderate or small, the space-time theorems still hold. And therefore, there is no escape from this cosmic beginning. And then another approach has come out of Britain where they say, well, you notice that we have all these movies. You ever ran into a movie or a TV show where they talk about wormholes? Yeah. Anybody, you know, okay, where you go through a wormhole and go to a different space-time realm. Wormholes, if you're not sure what a wormhole is, it's two black holes that come close enough together where it's possible to go from one space-time realm through the black hole where the singularity of black hole A perfectly touches the singularity of black hole B, and you can go through those two singularities and come out in a different space-time realm. Mathematically, that's possible, but we know it's physically impossible. I wrote about this in Lights in the Sky and Little Green Men, where I actually kind of show you the diagrams of these wormholes. But yeah, it makes for great science fiction, but it does not make for science reality. The reason why? The probability of getting the two black hole singularities to perfectly touch one another is zero. And moreover, these black hole singularities are not stable. They're in constant motion. Quantum mechanics tells us they must be in quantum, the quantum space-time fluctuations guarantee that they will be in motion, which means the probability of actually getting them to be touching one another and staying touching one another. I mean, even if they were to touch one another, they would touch one another for such a brief period of time, nothing can get through the wormhole. And incidentally, you don't want to get anywhere close to the event horizon of a black hole anyway, because when you do, the gravity will be so much stronger at your feet than at your head, it actually stretches your body out. The first thing you notice when you begin to approach a black hole is you get taller. And as you get close to the event horizon, you become 3 miles tall. Basically what happens is all of your particles that make up your human body become strung out into a long line. And then as you get into the event horizon, the particles get destroyed. You're not coming out at the other end. So, but the same principle applies if you're trying to attach a contracting universe it shrinks down to something less than what you have in the quantum gravity era, and then join up with an expanding universe that likewise is smaller than what you would have in the quantum gravity era. The probability of getting the two geometries to perfectly touch one another and remain stable is zero. You get the same problem as you would with the wormhole issue. Moreover, we now have possible ways of probing the quantum gravity era. And I mentioned two of these in the fourth edition of Crater in the Cosmos, is that if you've got big quantum space-time fluctuations in the quantum gravity era, quantum mechanics tells us that that's going to be manifested in the images of distant quasars and blazars. And these are like huge black holes in the center of active galaxies, where they're consuming large amounts of gas and stars, and hence they're very bright, because the conversion of matter into energy just beyond the event horizon is 10%. And to put that in context, the conversion of matter into energy in our sun is 0.07%. So you get this very bright emission just beyond the event horizon, and it's in a very small area, so it's a point source if we're talking about being at billions of light years away. However, the quantum space-time fluctuations in the quantum gravity era will be magnified in the images of these distant quasars and blazars. The farther the light travels through space, the greater the magnification. And the shorter the wavelength, the greater the magnification. And so what astronomers have done is they've looked at distant quasars and blazars at ultraviolet wavelengths to see if they can see any blurring. Because what if the quantum space-time fluctuations are large as what you need to escape the beginning of the universe, it's going to blur the images of distant quasars and blazars. And so far, we see no blurring. The images are sharp. And because they're sharp, it tells us the quantum space-time fluctuations can't be very big. Now, I debated an atheist on this, and he said, well, Hugh, it only rules out certain speculated models that try to escape the beginning of the universe. But the whole classes of atheistic models have now been ruled out as a result of those observations. But they said, we still got other models that allow us to escape the conclusions of the space-time theorems. But it says, here's what we're seeing. Every time we make an observational advance, it always sustains the biblical theistic worldview of the universe. It increases the evidence we have that there is a cosmic beginning. So every time we push forward with the observational capabilities, it always goes in favor of biblical theism. It's never gone against biblical theism. So just look at the history of the last 150 years. As our abilities to observe the universe have gotten more comprehensive, the evidence for the cosmic beginning has gotten stronger. And says, moreover, what we could do is actually look at more distant quasars. The best measurement we have so far for the image quality of a quasar is one that's 3 billion light years away at ultraviolet wavelengths. I says, we could look at one that's 12 billion light years away at X-ray wavelengths. So it says, we actually have the possibility of pushing deeper into the quantum gravity physics than we have today. It says, I'm willing to bet you that when we do that, it's going to force your atheistic speculations into a smaller and smaller corner. So that's already been happening. He says, yeah, but you're not going to be able to eliminate everything in the corner. He says, yeah, we never will. I says, you atheists will always be able to speculate in some region of ignorance about the universe and basically say things are so radically different that there is no beginning to the universe. And the analogy I've used, I put it in the fourth edition of The Crater in the Cosmos, the analogy I used was, I could actually come up with a theoretical model to explain away the human physical existence of my wife. I could say, look, you know, for 40 years, I've been fooled into thinking she's a real human being. In fact, she's just a very sophisticated three-dimensional hologram. And, you know, I've been deceived all these years. That's a possibility. On the other hand, the more experiments and observations I do in my wife, the more evidence I get that she really is. But can I ever come up with absolute proof that she's a physical human being? No. Even if I remain married to her for 200 years, I'm never going to come up with absolute proof. On the other hand, I can tell you this. 40 years ago, when I saw my wife walking down the aisle of this church on our day that we of our wedding day, I did it with the confidence that there was overwhelming practical proof that she really was a physical human being. I didn't have absolute proof that she was, but I had very strong practical evidence and proof that she was a real human being. So much so, I was prepared to live the rest of my life with her based on that lack of absolute proof. And so I shared this with this one atheist I was debating, saying, you know, it's like that for everything in our human existence. There's nothing we can prove to an absolute sense. And it's simply being an irrational consistency for you to demand absolute proof before you believe in God when you do all kinds of other things without absolute proof. It reaches a point where the evidence is adequate. Moreover, the very fact that we're seeing that now that we're able to penetrate the quantum gravity era, it sustains theism and not atheism, and it's pushing you back into a smaller corner. How small does that corner have to be before you say, you know what? I think there really is a God that created the universe. The universe really does have a beginning. Yes.
One more evidence is that holograms cannot procreate.
Holograms cannot procreate. Although I could argue that maybe a really sophisticated three-dimensional hologram could produce other three-dimensional sophisticated. So maybe my two sons aren't human beings either. They're just sophisticated three-dimensional holograms that have reproduced that way. But you know, if I actually look at all the evidence, I realize the evidence is overwhelming, the physics, the observations. And that's kind of what I shared with this one atheist physicist is, aren't you impressed that 100% of the experimental and observational evidence we have about the universe screams that it's got a beginning in finite time? It's 100%. He says, you're not able to point out any evidence. He says, well, we might be able to come up with evidence. That was this whole basis, saying, you know, as we begin to penetrate the quantum gravity era, maybe we'll come up with some evidence. And one I mentioned in the Creator and the Cosmos 4th edition is the fact that we're now able to use radio astronomy to map the event horizons of black holes. We've only done it on one black hole so far, but they're working on doing it with other black holes. And the reason why is that we can actually measure in detail, map in detail what's happening just outside the event horizon of a black hole that actually tells us what's going on in the quantum gravity era. And my physicist friend was basically saying, yeah, when they have that, maybe give some evidence, some experimental observational evidence that could possibly sustain an atheistic worldview perspective. And I said, well, that's an interesting speculation. And I'm willing to speculate it's going to go the opposite way. He says, well, as long as there's the possibility of us developing observational evidence that there is no beginning of the universe, that's where I'm going to hang my hat. But I would argue that's really not a rational way to look at the evidence, because I could use the same argument to disbelieve anything else I wanted to disbelieve. Right over here.
So are you saying that belief is a choice?
I'm saying that belief...
What you believe is your choice.
Yeah, what you believe is your choice. But I would argue you can believe what you want, but if you're trying to claim that belief is rational, logical, that's something we can put to the test. And so I would have been happy if my physicist friend said, you know, just like with David Berlinski, I'm not claiming to be logical or rational, but this is my choice. But the fact is he was trying to insist he was being logical and rational, based on the fact that there is a possibility that we could come up with experimental and observational evidence that there is no cosmic beginning. And basically said, as long as that possibility exists, I'm not going to believe. Well, again, I could use that argument about anything else that I believe, including the belief that my sons are physical human beings and my wife is a physical human being. So that's one reason why I use that extreme example. Because I think bottom line is, the evidence we have for the existence of God is stronger than the evidence I have that my wife is a human being. And if that's the case, And incidentally, my friend wasn't married. So I think it'd be different if you were married. You might actually recognize that there are things that we can prove. And bottom line, it's kind of like there is another reason why they disbelieve. If they're gonna, but what I was hoping for is that he would actually admit that his belief is not based on logic and rationality. I did not get that far with him.
Well, in the case of David Berlinski, I think maybe it was like he didn't want to face the rejection of his family and all the consequences of that. I think sometimes that's the way they are. So in a certain way, maybe it's logical, but only from a, you know, natural mind's point of view.
Well, that's a good point. I think for David Block, it was different because he actually saw numbers of his family go from Judaism to Christianity. And that made it a lot easier. You know, in David Berlinski's case, I'm not sure there's any of his relatives that are Christian. So that makes a big difference. But I think you're raising another point.
Well, they're Jewish though,
right? Right. But I think this extends beyond Judaism. You know, it took my mother 30 years to become a Christian. But I think one reason why it took her that long, she had a daughter that was an atheist. And for her to become a Christian is basically saying, my daughter is wrong. And she very much admired that daughter. And so that was a barrier for her. But eventually got to the point where she said, I can't let that be a barrier. It also helped when my sister basically said, you know, the reason why my marriage collapsed as we left God out of our marriage. So I kind of encouraged my mother, well, maybe they're really, you know, maybe my sister is not an atheist. My older sister is the one remaining non-Christian in my immediate family, but she has a son who's, both of her sons are committed atheists, and one she's really attached to. And I'm thinking until something happens in his life, she's not going to budge because it's the same emotional situation. If I become a Christian, I'm rejecting the belief of my son. And so these emotional bonds we have, especially the emotional bonds in families, can be a source of irrationality in terms of what do we do with the God issue. Go ahead.
I just think there is the personality factor for David Berlinski, because when you listen to him, he's very sardonic, and kind of negative, and it just seems like there's a personality factor in his lack of belief, too.
Well, I think you're on to something with David because he's very good at proving what's not true. It's a little bit different when you try to put him on, okay, let's see what is true. And incidentally, I interviewed him on our TV show because he is so good at being able to establish what's not true. And so it's valuable. And it tells us in Scripture that the Word of God is a two-edged sword. And I believe the two edges are, for most of us, we come to Christ by discovering what is true and what is not true. It's kind of like both edges are important. But I think often what happens with people is they're only being exposed to one edge. And so you need to give them both. And that's just a tip in evangelism. I found that when leading people to Christ, especially people who've got a lot of educational background, they need both edges. It's not enough to tell them what is true. You got to tell them what is not true. But I tell you, so much of evangelism today in the Christian faith is focusing on proving to people what is not true. That's why we've structured Reasons to Believe to take a more positive approach, because we see it as a missing element in the evangelistic effort of the church. There needs to be more focus on establishing what is true, rather than just pointing out to people where they're wrong. You know, people don't like being pointed out what they're wrong. They love pointing out where you're wrong. And so that's often how we engage. In fact, that's typically how we engage scientists. We go on their campus or in their lab and basically say, here's our model. Can you offer us some critique? So we're inviting them to put us on the defensive. And it's a way that they get to find just how good the evidence really is. By the way, time is running away on us. I want to give you this clip. Let me pull this back for you. Hold it. Here we go. Here it is. I found this on the web, and if you really want to see something spectacular, this is on my Facebook and Twitter page already. So if you just want to go there, you can click on it. This is a 17-minute video clip, and it's done by people who've made the most extensive map of the local universe. And they basically put this into 3D animation. In my opinion, it's the most spectacular tour you can take of the local universe, and it really shows you the incredible design features of the collection of local superclusters the area around our Lanikaia supercluster. So http://vimeo.com, Pomerade, Pomarede, Cosmography. That will take you right there. And it's, yeah, it was really spectacular in my opinion. It's, you've got this French astronomer who kind of tells you what's going on. Her English is very good, but her accent is a bit rough. So just get used to the accent and you'll be fine. But yeah, just you can turn the sound off if you want, because I just encourage you. It's a great place to go to really see how wonderfully designed our universe indeed is. So what's sufficient about the cosmic beginning? If any of you want to dig into more detail than this, I'd encourage you to read the book Why the Universe is the Way It Is and The Creator and the Cosmos, fourth edition. Why the Universe is the Way It Is basically makes the point we need to look more than just the beginning of the universe and the purpose for God creating the universe 13.8 billion years ago. Why he took so long in developing the universe for human beings, why it has these four forces of physics. And the bottom line is, God created the universe not just to be a home for us human beings, to be a home for physical life. He created it so that billions of human beings can be redeemed from their sin and evil. The primary reason why the universe looks the way it is to be a tool in God's hands to eradicate evil while he enhances the free will capability of the redeemed. Because that's the promise of the new creation. We're going to experience love in the new creation, orders and orders of magnitude greater than what's possible in this creation. In this creation, the laws of physics restrain the amount of love we can express and experience. In the new creation, we're not going to have gravity, we're not going to have thermodynamics, we're not going to have electromagnetism or the strong and weak nuclear force. We're going to be delivered from the restraints of the laws of physics to experience love to a degree far greater than was possible in this universe. But not until sin and evil are eradicated. The reason why we have these laws of physics is so that sin and evil do not run out of control, that they can be restrained by the physics. But once evil is eradicated, there's no longer a need for the restraints. And this is something that a lot of my atheist friends have never thought about. In fact, I've had some great conversations with atheist physicists and astronomers saying, have you ever thought about the universe as a tool in the hands of the Creator to eradicate evil once and for all, while he enhances our ability to experience love? So our free will capability will actually be enhanced. And this explains why it has these laws of physics, why it has quantum mechanics, and why quantum mechanics and things like general relativity must be the way they are. So that's another way you can kind of help them get over this idea that maybe there's an escape hatch for the cosmic beginning. The escape hatches that they speculate will not operate as a significant restraint of evil and sin and of suffering. Okay, with that I want to segue to number two, human beings are exceptional. And my colleague Faisal Rana and A.J. Roberts, they would argue that this is probably in 2020 is actually a more common place where the atheist is going than the beginning of the universe. And I think they're making a valid point. The debate about the beginning of the universe can become so exceptionally technical and mathematical in the way it's framed that most people are left in the dark. But with human exceptionalism, you're dealing with things that are mathematically much simpler. Now, I would argue that the database is far more complex. human beings are extremely complex, animals are extremely complex. So I'd argue the complexity is far greater than what you get in astrophysics, but it doesn't have the mathematical challenges. And I think they're making a point. In terms of what's happening in the atheistic scientific community today, number two here is really where most are involved. And this is something we've seen as we've been debating different elements of the Christian community and the non-theistic community. This seems to be where the debate is going on whether or not what the Bible tells us about human beings and our Christian faith is true. Well, I think what's different too is that within Christianity, there seems to be a consensus that this cosmic beginning really is important. I don't hear any of my Christian peers saying, well, you know, I kind of agree with the atheists that maybe these space-time theorems don't prove that there's a cosmic beginning. They're really agreeing with us. I mean, you see that throughout the whole community of theistic evolutionists. They're on board with us that this is a pillar of the Christian faith and that the science and the Bible really do teach a cosmic beginning. And so number two is important. It's not just a debate between Christians and atheists. It's a debate between Christians and Christians. Yes.
When I think of people arguing about human beings being exceptional, why wouldn't you want to lift yourself up as human beings? Why would you put yourself down and compare yourself to an ape? That doesn't make sense to me. But then when you look at the spiritual aspect, that we're made in the image of God, and people who are angry at God or don't believe in God do not like his image, including themselves. So they can easily compare themselves to something less of a human being, closer to an ape, because Satan can't stand God's image and anything to do with his image, and we are the perfect image of God.
Yeah, if we really do have the image of God, then God is actually in relationship with us. It means he's responsible, he's looking at us, he's evaluating us. And I see that in the writings of the now passed away Stephen Hawking. He was fine with deism. He couldn't handle atheism or theism because it meant that he would be accountable to this God. This God would be watching over him. He wanted to be free to do what he wanted. But you're making a good point. You would think any human being in the right mind would be arguing for human exceptionalism just based on their own self-esteem. Okay, what's wrong with you that you think you're just like a pig or a bacterium? I mean, aren't you? But, you know, I've gotten this humorous response from people going down that path. They would say, you know, I would argue that I am greater than all these animals out there. I'm just not sure about you. So that's kind of how they get their self-esteem. In other words, they would argue that they're more exceptional than the rest of the human species. It's the rest of us that really don't understand all the stuff they understand. But you're making an excellent point. I mean, why would you demote yourself to being just like a bacterium or just like a rat or a mouse? Okay, we got a question over here. Get the microphone over.
It's really, I think, more of a statement, but I think some people demote themselves because you'll find this with environmentalists and people who are animal activists. They don't believe in being species biased. In other words, we're no better than anything else, so we need to put ourselves equal or below other animals. So I've seen it in that regard.
Well, I mean, you see people like Singer making that point, that there's no difference between humans and the mammals that are out there. We need to consider them as our equals and treat them like they're our equals. And actually argues that mothers should have the right to terminate their children until they're 2 years of age. Because after all, I mean, we do that with chickens, we do that with other life forms, what's the difference? So you're making a good point. This is a hot issue today, and it's an important issue. And this is one reason why we at Reason to Believe decided to take this very seriously. A lot of our books are being written on this. It explains why a month ago we held a human origins workshop where we invited leading atheist scholars and theistic evolutionary scholars. And it's recorded, by the way. You can watch that workshop. And I think I got a URL for the workshop. Let me see if I can find it here for you. Yeah, here it is. Come on. What's happening here? I'm trying to get this thing to play. Here we go. Reasons.org Human Origins Workshop 2020. That'll pop it up for you. And you can watch about three quarters of that workshop. In particular, a debate between a theistic evolutionist and Faisal Rana at Reasons to Believe. But I thought that was what was so interesting about this workshop is that you see you've got Christians holding a wide variety of views on human exceptionalism. Then you got the atheists who are denying human exceptionalism. But the fact that it's right within the church, and I think what you'll find interesting, people that take a very strong evangelical Christian stance hold quite a radically different view than we do here at Reasons to Believe. So there's a wide spectrum of beliefs on what's going on with human exceptionalism. Microphone.
We're out of time.
We're out of time. Okay, I thought you were going to ask a question. All right.
I wanted to, but we're out of time.
You're going to want to, but you'll hold that till next week. Okay, we'll dig into this. And hey, if this coronavirus gets a little more out of control, I will be here next week. If things look really good with the virus, I'm going to be in Virginia speaking at Regent University. But, you know, we got Mark Perez back there. He always makes sure that we've got an excellent teacher here in the class when I'm not here. So with that, let me bow in prayer. Father in heaven, Lord, we pray that you give us many opportunities this week as people are obviously concerned about this virus. Lord, it would give us opportunities just to share what we know about viruses, how it fits into your good plan, and how we can avoid some of the human abuses that allow these viruses to be as dangerous as they are, how we can take appropriate precautions. And Lord, we're so grateful that we've gone an entire century without a viral outbreak of this nature. And so, Lord, we're grateful that your hand has been upon us, even with our human abuses, that we've not suffered the consequences to the degree that we could have. So we're grateful for that. And Father, I pray that you'd also give us opportunities as we as Christians actually expose the testability of our Christian faith, the falsibility of our Christian faith. But Lord, these three things that would, if proven to be true, would utterly be catastrophic to our Christian faith, if proven to be true, would sustain our Christian faith. So Lord, we thank you that this is such a hot issue this day, and I pray again it would open up many opportunities for us to be able to share the good news that there really is a God out there, a God that's created everything, that loves us, and wants to have a relationship with us. So Lord, I pray you give us many opportunities to be witnesses for you, and to see your Holy Spirit bring people to faith in Christ. In Jesus' name, amen. Thank you.